I appreciate that hymn very much. It is the purpose that we've come together is to worship God. We come to fellowship. We come to learn. But I think we need to come first to worship the Lord our God. That's what He wants from us. Brother Ray said, as he told you, I should introduce myself. I guess it's opportunity. You won't get a better introduction than the one you give yourself, I guess. You won't find my name in Who's Who, so whatever you want to know about me, you're going to have to get right now. Hay and I have been married for a little over 30 years. She's been a loving and faithful wife, and we live there close to East Berlin. I know many of you well, and some of you I know by face, and some of you, of course, I don't know, but we're not far away, and we sense a great kinship with this congregation. God has blessed us over those years with 8 children, and they're imperfect children because they have imperfect parents, but we're grateful for each of them. Our oldest, Jonathan, found his wife from this congregation, and God has blessed them with 3 children. Riley is not yet even a week old, but we're glad for each of them as well. Many of you know Carla, our oldest daughter, our secondborn. She's serving in Thailand, and I've thought before, and I thought again as Brother Ray was explaining where your offering would go this morning. Maybe we could get some of this literature translated into Thai. She can speak Thai. Well, she's still learning, but she can carry a conversation well in Thai. And she works with people who do know the language well and would desire would desire to learn more of God's way. She's familiar with a church where the pastor is a first-generation Christian. And he's talked of coming to America, believe it or not, to learn how to do church. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Come to America to find out how to do church. They are growing in the Lord in number and in understanding. And it just might be an opportunity that God would lead us to sometime. Nearly 5 years ago, we lost one of our children, and he was our 3rd born. Many of you ministered to us, prayed for us over that time, and we're grateful for that. The other 5 are still at home and growing. And we've had, as I said, with 8 children over that time, it seems like we've always had young ones. And now we're finding that there's events that even our youngest is too old for. It's kind of becoming a new experience for us. Even this morning, only our youngest went to Sunday school. The rest stayed here. And so our family is growing up, and we're enjoying it as we go. Well, this morning, we know as Palm Sunday. And the scripture that we had read this morning is the account of Jesus riding into Jerusalem there, the first day of the week, of the last week that he was here on earth. Each of the gospel writers gives us an account of that event. By the way, here, as I start looking down at my notes, I realize my glasses are in my way. I really should have bifocals, I guess. My glasses work best for me when I'm driving, when I need to see in the distance. And to look at you, I thought I'd put my glasses on. I can see you better. To preach, probably most of the time, I'm going to have them off. Now, we all know that We look on the outside. God looks on the heart. So how I see you and how you see me is really kind of secondary. Okay? But maybe from time to time I'll put these on. I'll have them off most of the time. But I'll put them on. It'll just kind of be our code. He can see me better now, but God sees my heart. That'll just be our code. Okay? So if you see me put them on, just remember that. All right? And I'm going to take them off. You all look pretty good, by the way. Some of you look even better now. Anyhow, the Gospels each give us an account of Palm Sunday. Now, Mark's account tells us that the last thing Mark's account tells us, we're not told exactly how all these things happened, but the last thing in Mark's account before this event was Jesus restoring sight to a blind Bartimaeus on the outskirts of Jericho. In Luke's account, the chapter that contains this entry into Jerusalem also tells us about Zacchaeus. Most of us are familiar with that story. And then the parable of the 10 pounds. John tells us that the night before, because that account says the next day, and it goes into this account, the night before is when they had that evening there, a supper in honor of Jesus, and Mary anointed his feet with a costly ointment. Many of us are familiar with that account. It had been a while since Jesus had been at Jerusalem. He had been there, and as you know, Jerusalem was the political and religious center of Israel. And the religious leaders of the time had rejected Jesus and the message that he brought. They had really rejected John the Baptist's message as well, and they rejected Jesus' message. They were comfortable in their life, their sin. They didn't want you to think maybe they were sinning, but they were comfortable where they were, and they were not at all impressed with Jesus' message of truth and holiness and their need for repentance. As a matter of fact, they were jealous of the following that Jesus was acquiring. And he really, in their eyes, was a wanted man. Wanted in the same sense that those people whose pictures we see sometimes in the post office are wanted. They'd like to get their hands on him. They'd like to find a way to get him out of the way so they could go on with life without his irritation. John's account, chapter 11, before the triumphal entry, we hear of Lazarus. And Jesus and his disciples get the news that he is sick. Now, Lazarus and his sisters, if you recall, lived in Bethany. Bethany was not far from Jerusalem. It was too close, really, for comfort for someone who was being sought. But Jesus announced, hey, Lazarus is sick. And now he's actually fallen asleep. Let's go. And you know the story. He said, well, if he fell asleep, he'll be all right. He'll recover. And he said, no, he's dead. But we're going to go, and you're going to see the glory of God. You and the rest of them will see the glory of God. They knew it was a dangerous thing. And Thomas, one of his disciples, said, let us also go that we may die with him. They were very well aware that Jesus could easily lose his life. He got too close to Jerusalem. They understood it was a dangerous place for Jesus to be. Jesus knew, though, what he was doing. He knew what was going to happen. As a matter of fact, the main reason that he had come to earth was to give his life as a ransom for many. He was not staying away from Jerusalem to avoid that. He was just waiting for the right time. He was going, and he was going to do what he had come to do. In Matthew's account, he even told them about that. He said, "We're going to Jerusalem. I will be betrayed. I'll be delivered into the hands of the chief priests and scribes. I'll be mocked. I'll be scourged. I'll even be crucified. But in 3 days, I'm going to rise again." That's what we're going to do. And so as we come to this section this morning, Jesus is coming, as it were, out of seclusion. He's coming to Jerusalem. He's not coming under cover of darkness. He's not sneaking in. He's coming. And we want to notice some things about him as he comes. First of all, we notice that Jesus, he knows the unknowable. He knows what no one else knows. The Bible clearly teaches that Jesus is 100% God and 100% man. How can anything be 100% of two different things? That is a mathematical impossibility. That is a physical impossibility. That is a human impossibility. But that's the way it was. How the eternal, omniscient, omnipotent God could put himself in a human body and live in time is a mystery that greater minds than mine for centuries have tried to understand and tried to explain. But that's what happened when Jesus came to earth. The Bible teaches it clearly, and Jesus demonstrated it in different ways. Now the Bible does say, speaking of the child Jesus, the boy, that he increased in wisdom and in learning and in favor, or wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. Now, how could the omniscient God, you know what omniscient means, right? All-knowing. How could the all-knowing God be taught anything? How could the eternal one age? How could he increase in years? The eternal one. I can't quite get that together. But Jesus, certainly as a boy, was taught to work with wood, wasn't he? By Joseph. But how could this one who created the world, the universe, with a word be taught anything? I can't fully explain it. Now, I don't think, I might be wrong, but I don't think Jesus was totally cognizant or aware of all his deity as he lay in the manger in Bethlehem. I don't know what you think. I don't think he was. I don't think he knew it. How that came upon him, I'm not sure. But the Bible clearly indicates that there came a time when Jesus could perceive the thoughts of those around him and the unspoken questions in their mind and address them before they verbalize them. Somehow, sometime along the way, that ability came to him, whether it came gradually, whether it came upon him when he was baptized or whatever, I don't know. But that happened in his life. And now here in this passage before us today, just a few days before his crucifixion, he instructs two of his disciples, "You're going ahead, you're going to find this colt, this unbroken donkey. You, on time, you bring it to me. When you get questioned, you tell them this. They'll let them come. You give them the whole story. This is the way it's going to be. This is the way I'm going in Jerusalem. And go ahead and go get that colt for me. Now, I don't know, as I read that, I wondered in the past why anyone would need an unbroken colt. And there are different understandings and explanations of that. Apparently, animals that were used in the Old Testament for sanctified purposes were unbroken, unused colts or unused beasts. But at any rate, it seemed to me that riding an unbroken colt in a shouting crowd where they're waving branches and all that kind of thing would be kind of dangerous, a little bit like trying to drive a car in a parade without a steering wheel and a brake pedal. It wouldn't work too good if you've ever been around an unbroken colt. Some suggest that there was an arrangement made with the owner of this colt and that he was going to give that. I don't know. We're not told so if there was. I rather believe it is another indication that Jesus knew what was going to happen and he wanted to demonstrate his knowledge and his power. At any rate, we can be sure that today God in his glorified state in heaven doesn't... There's nothing that he can be told that he doesn't already know. He knows our down sitting and our uprising. He understands our every thought. He knows the words before we say them. He knows the motives of our hearts. He knows where we've been. He knows who we've been with. He knows what we've done. All things are naked and open to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. We have amazing technology in our day, and we can get information a lot of places, and we can keep track of a lot of things. One of the most amazing things that's becoming more and more commonplace and finding more and more applications is this system called GPS, Global Positioning Systems. Many of you are familiar with that. A lot of you have those systems in your vehicles already. A lot of applications for GPS. It's used in the transportation industry to keep track of freight and trucks, where they are, and make sure everything's the way it should be there. They're used in agriculture. They're used to guide equipment or to guide the driver, so he can steer his equipment in a very precise way in a field. And not only that, they actually are used to guide the equipment. Some of the newest equipment is guided by the satellite information. The driver just goes along in case something gets wrong or to make some turns or make some adjustments. And it's very precise. Sprayers years ago were in banks, and you had those valves that you turn on and off by hand, 1, 2, 3 usually. Now there's more sections, and you know what a point row is. If you come and approach in a field and your boom or your whatever, this side will get to where you've already planted or sprayed, and you want to turn it off. And you could used to do that with a switch then, one at a time. Now if you have the right system, each section will shut off by itself as it gets so you don't overlap. Not only that, each nozzle in some systems shuts off one at a time as it gets to that particular spot in the field where you've already sprayed. You can't even see it, but it'll do it. Corn planters the same way, shutting off maybe 2 rows at a time so you're not double planting. Amazing technology. GPS systems are used in recreation. I read some time ago about soccer balls that are equipped with sensors. And around the arena are different transmitters that are sending signals, and with all that information, the precise location of that ball as it relates to the field is known. And so when that ball gets across the goal line, the referee has on his arm a device, something like a watch, that'll vibrate. And so even if he's not really in a position to see if it was a goal or not, he can signal that there was a goal because he gets that information from the sensors that are watching the exact location of that ball in the soccer game. Now, if man can use satellites in space to monitor the movement of trucks and to guide a sprayer or some other a farm implement across the field in a precise way, if they can use satellites and high-flying aircraft to take pictures that are so defined they can read your license plate or something that small from space, if man can make listening devices that can pick up what's behind closed doors and transmit that conversation to a remote location, or use sensors, infrared sensors, to monitor the movement of people inside a building from a distance, do we think that we can hide anything from God? He who formed the ear, shall he not hear? He who formed our eyes, will he not see? He who corrects and disciplines nations, will he not correct us? This idea that God knows everything is an easy one to say, but it's kind of hard to really, really grasp. You know, we know a lot. Most of all, we know there's a lot we don't know. It's amazing how much we don't know. One time I was working with a man, and I had a question, and he had been in the business longer than I, and I thought surely he should know the answer. And I asked him this particular question, and he said, "Well, I don't know, Dan." And he could tell that I was surprised, you know. He said, "You know, it's amazing how much I don't know." And I just remembered that, and I use that often myself. People ask me questions and say, "I don't know. It's amazing how much I don't know." And it's true. We don't know an awful lot, but God knows everything. We don't know, for example, about tomorrow. I think many times of that song, "Many things about tomorrow, I don't seem to understand. But I know who holds tomorrow, and I know who holds my hand." There is nothing unknown to God. We know that. We need to be reminded sometimes. Another thing we notice in this account was that not only God, Jesus, knows the unknowable, what's unknowable to the rest of us, or as we observe each other, he knows, but he also controls what to us is totally uncontrollable. I mentioned that colt, an unbroken colt, and how it'd be a little bit like a vehicle without a steering wheel or brakes, or maybe they ran at full throttle and you couldn't do anything with it. Now, if you've ever had an unbroken colt, you know that that's kind of an amazing thing. I remember when I was a boy, a young boy, we got a pony. We called her Candy. And we kept her most of the time in a stall. And when my dad would get home in the afternoon from his truck driving job, he would sometimes get his long rope out with a clip on the end. And he'd get Candy and clip that end of that rope onto her halter and lead her out of that stall, and she was ready to go. And as he got her outside there, he just started giving a rope, and she'd take off. Just bucking and kicking and jumping and running, And he'd just give her rope till he's in the rope and just let her run around, just round in circles, till she was just worn out. And I'll tell you what, I remember, I don't know if we were ever going to ride that pony. I certainly couldn't have held on to her then. Eventually, we got her broke and we were able to ride her. But an unbroken colt, that's a pretty uncontrollable thing. We can't control the weather. We can't control the other person that's driving, whether we're in the vehicle with them or they're coming toward us or coming this way. We can't control that. We can't even control who our relatives are. They say you can pick your friends, but you can't pick your relatives. We can't even control that. We can't control the cost of so many of the things that we buy. We can try to affect it by saying, well, I just don't need that. Sometimes the price doesn't come down anyhow. We can't control it that much. There's many things we can't control. Now, maybe your life feels more like you're riding an unbroken colt, less like you're riding a docile donkey. Maybe your life, there's things that are obviously out of control. You're trying to hang on and the critter's bucking and jumping and twisting and turning and you're not sure if you're going to be able to make it. Well, the best thing for you to do is acknowledge it's out of your control, but God is still in control. I think again of that song, He's got the whole world in His hands. He's got you and me. He's got everybody here. You know, you can put a lot of lines to that, and they're all true. He's got it all in His hands. He's in control of it all, and nothing's going to get out of control with Him. Now, if we go back to that account of how Lazarus was raised from the dead there in John 11, we know that Lazarus got sick, and Mary and Martha loved their brother, and they sent for Jesus. And the Bible tells us that Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus. And for that reason, it says, not in those words, but it says, for that reason, He abode still in the same place where He was. He loved them. And so instead of running to them when they got word that Lazarus was sick, He stayed. He let the colt buck and kick and twist till Lazarus got thrown off. Then He said, now let's go. He got there. First He met Martha. Martha told Him, you're too late. You should have got here sooner. And Jesus said, you don't understand. Had the same interchange with Mary. They went to the tomb. He said, take the stone away. He said, no, we can't do that. He's been bucked off already. He's dead. It was 4 days ago. We can't do that. He said, you don't understand. It's out of your control. But it's not out of my control. Take the stone away. You're in over your head. But it's not over my head. Believe what I'm telling you. Do what I say. Take the stone away. And they did. And they saw a great miracle. They saw their brother raised from the dead. And many others saw as well. Just a few short days after that Palm Sunday, the disciples got thrown off course. They had seen Jesus do many things. They had seen Him raise Lazarus. They had seen Him walk across the Sea of Galilee on the sea, water. They had seen Him take a little bit of food and break it and break it and break it until thousands had more than enough with lots left over. They had seen all kinds of things. And then when they came for Jesus that night, nothing like that happened. oh yeah, that servant got his ear put back on, but still they took Jesus away. And his hands were bound. And he just went with them. And they watched how they treated him, how they scourged him. They saw that he was crucified. And they thought that it was all over. But what they found out was that Jesus even had control of death. Death was not too much for him. So how about you this morning? Is there something in your life that's totally out of control? No matter what it is, it's not out of God's control. Remember that. And with God, if He's not coming as fast as you think He can or should, it's just like with Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. He's delaying for a greater blessing. I don't know what it is, but it's in His control. One last thing, briefly, is that Jesus, we see in this account, He bears with the uneducated. Those that didn't understand what was going on. The crowd and even His disciples. In Luke's account of this riding into Jerusalem, we read that as He got closer to Jerusalem and He beheld that city, He wept. He knew that many in that admiring crowd, now shouting Hosanna, blessed is He that comes in the name of the Lord, would in a few days be saying, crucify Him. Get rid of Him. And with a prophetic eye, Jesus looked out and knew the judgment that was going to come on that nation and on that city. And He wept. Even so, He bore with them. He offered them love, mercy, forgiveness, compassion. But it broke His heart. And He wept. He deserved their worship. He deserved better than they could give Him. But they didn't really understand. And God looks down on us now. And He longs and deserves our praise, our worship, our adoration, the best we can give, and better. And as He looks down, does His heart rejoice? Or does it make Him weep? We've all made Him weep sometimes, haven't we? Even now, as He looks down, He doesn't need my glasses. He looks down. He looks at our hearts. And what does He see? Does He rejoice or weep? The multitudes in Jesus' day didn't really know what they were saying or doing. Even the disciples didn't. Jesus bore with them. And He extends His mercy and His everlasting truth and love to all generations, even down to ours. I can't imagine what it would be like to be all knowing, to not have to be informed about anything. I can't imagine what it would be like to have nothing that was too difficult to do. Can you imagine that? Nothing too difficult. That's our God. Nothing He doesn't know. Nothing He can't do. But this was our sovereign God. This was Christ. This He demonstrated as He rode into Jerusalem that last Sunday. And yet, He doesn't force Himself on us. He was going into Jerusalem that day. There was no stopping Him. He knew what was going to happen, and it was going to be. But when He comes to us, He comes and stands outside until he's invited in. To the church in Laodicea, he said, I'll stand at the door and knock. But that knock is to be answered individually. That invitation is addressed to a church. It was to the church at Laodicea, but the invitation is personal. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man, it's singular. If any person, if any woman, if any boy, if any girl will open the door, I will come in and sup with him. What are churches made up of? Individuals. Individuals who personally have opened the door. That's what it is. Individuals who open the door. One at a time. And I'm wondering this morning, as he knocks, will you let him in? That's a choice that we all make. Shall I let him in? I'm going to give you that opportunity. That's what one of the main reasons of a series of service like this is, to invite those who have never accepted Christ to come. I'm going to sing a hymn of meditation. And if you sense him knocking at your heart, stand or come forward while we sing.